see you all again, and thank you for your loyalty and sticking it out. It's, yesterday we had an easy time. I gave you an easy time, and I gave myself an easy time, basically because for 1,000 years, as you discovered, a few little advances were made, but basically not much happened. So tonight, in an hour, we have to cover the biggest upheaval in cultural life in Europe that there's ever been. For the art historian, and this is called the Renaissance, for the philosopher, it's the age of enlightenment and the age of reason, and for the scientist, it's the scientific revolution, back to back to back, all compressed in a very short time. And these events had profound effect on the fundamentals of clinical medicine, though, as I said yesterday, I hesitate to suggest that this translated during this period into anything very useful for the patient. But nonetheless, the seeds were sown. And as I prepared this, I kept asking myself, what suddenly happened that made man suddenly come alive intellectually after almost 1,000 years in the doldrums? And I'm sure historians argue among themselves as to what the seminal events were, but it strikes me there were three events. And the first was journeys of navigation and exploration by sea. Now you may say, what's that got to do with the Renaissance and the intellectual ferment? But I think it's important because as the great navigators set sail, people at home, when they came back, realized there was a world beyond their immediate horizon. And I think this must have had some psychological effect. The great voyages, of course, started with Bartholomew Dias setting out at the behest of King John II of Portugal to find a sea route to India. And you're familiar with his route, of course, through the Cape, culminating in the Bay of Algoa because his sailors basically mutinied and refused to go any further. And it took 11 years for Vasco da Gama to continue the journey to India, where he eventually became viceroy for the Portuguese royal family. The adventurer and navigator Christopher Columbus went to King John in Portugal, knowing that he'd patronized Dias, asking if he could have patronage for a trip westward, seeking a westward passage to India, and he was rebuffed and found himself in the court of Ferdinand and Isabella, and in 1492, under the Spanish flag with his three ships, sailed forth towards the west, finding Bermuda and Hispaniola, which he claimed for Spain. And of the three explorers we've mentioned, it was Columbus who had the most impact on medicine, as we shall see. The second stimulus, I think, for this cultural upheaval is the one man I would give my vote to as the most important person of the second millennium, Johannes Gutenberg. And I used to think, and I think probably you do as well, that great inventions come like a bolt of lightning to a genius who suddenly invents something. But as you probe the story of Gutenberg, it wasn't like that, and nor is it for most of the great inventors. And what they do is recognize something that had gone before, modify it, and find it suddenly had a great application. And this is exactly the story of Gutenberg, who, of course, had developed movable type, and from whom all printing originated. His father was a goldsmith working for the ecclesiastical mint in Mainz. And part of young Johannes' job was to help his father prepare prints of the dies of the medals that the mint was producing. And what he would do, he would line up the dies from which the medals were going to be cast, put them in a box, inked them, put some paper, and made an impression so that the quality of the die could be assessed before medals were actually struck. And then it occurred to him, instead of medals, dies, why not put letters? What a simple little adjusting thought. And as a result of that, a cultural revolution, the like of which I think we've not seen before, nor since almost. Perhaps the internet is the next thing that comes to mind. But short of that, difficult to think of anything else. And so he assembled a press himself, assembled the letters in reverse, of course, made words, paragraphs, and whatever, inked them in the same way that he'd been doing for his father with the dies of the ecclesiastical press, and made prints, and as a consequence he was able to churn out print after print after print. His great work, of course, was the Bible, because nonetheless this was still the main source of literature for Western man throughout this period. And there remained 48 examples of what are called the Gutenberg Bibles, and if you're fortunate enough to see them, you will appreciate that these, even today, are regarded as the acme of the printer's art. Absolutely remarkable and hand-decorated, as you can see. The third person I regard as seminal in this revolution was an Augustinian monk, Martin Luther. And Luther, as you know, was the father of Protestantism, and what incensed him, as I'm sure you know as well, was the fact that the service in the church was unintelligible to the lay people, and he thought it should be in the vernacular, in his case German. He recalled that Jesus lived in poverty, and yet he could not reconcile that with the glories of the church dripping in gold while the people were poor. And he recognized that why should man have to intercede with God via a clergyman or a pope? Surely that's something a man can do. But what really set him afire was the sale of indulgences. And as a consequence of these four principles that disturbed him hugely, he wrote his famous 95 Theses. And the 95 Theses were expounding his justification for the criticisms that he had voiced previously. And thanks to the press, it is said that in between 1522 and 1544, remember that all printing was done by hand by the monks throughout Western Europe for 1,000 years, in those 2 years, it is said, 100,000 copies of his 95 Theses were distributed throughout Western Europe. The genie was clearly out of the bottle. And this obviously didn't sit well with Leo X. And as a consequence, as we know, he was excommunicated and lucky to have escaped with his life, I suspect. And it was only a few years later, a few decades later, that Copernicus joined the revolution by daring to propose that the sun and not the earth was the centre of the known universe. And this, of course, was validated by Galileo with his observations, and these observations were subsequently refined by Kepler. And now, of course, we know that the sun is the centre and not the earth, and this didn't sit well with the church either. So knowing the power the church held for 1,000 years before, and this explosion of liberated thought, voyages of discovery, a new way of thinking about one's religion, and the ability to disseminate thoughts widely, was absolutely revolutionary. And I would happily afterwards discuss with historians of the time other factors that may come into play. But looking at this afresh some months ago as I prepared this, it struck me these were the three seminal events that I could identify. How did all this impact on medicine, doctors, and disease? Well, the first thing, of course, was Columbus came back with things, the medicinal, the botanicals that the local native people in the lands that he discovered in the West and the Caribbean were using for medicine. So he came back, of course, with chicona bark, which the native peoples were using for fever. And the commonest cause of fever among them was malaria. And we subsequently know that the chicona bark contains quinine, which for many, many years was the staple for the treatment of that condition. In addition, he discovered that the local people were chewing cocoa leaves. And the cocoa leaves had two effects. It was a stimulant, and it was also an analgesic. And we now know that that contains cocaine, which for many years, before its abuse in more recent times, was a widely used local anesthetic. It was a two-way street, however, because it also brought back syphilis, as we shall see shortly. And this picture by Durer illustrates a syphilitic, and the syphilis that Columbus brought back was a virulent strain of syphilis, because syphilis itself had been endemic in Europe for many, many centuries. And yet this was a decimating disease, and those who have been going to the Schubert at the Baxter in the evenings will know that this brought down Schubert himself at the age of 31 as recently as the early second decade of the 19th century. A terrible affliction. The great sea voyages also had another effect, and this is a picture of James Lind, L-I-N-D, a British sailor in the Royal Navy, who made an observation. The first observation was that among the sailors that had gone with Vasco da Gama, finally reaching India and back, one half of the crew died of scurvy. It was the custom, as you know, in the British Royal Navy to give rum to the sailors, but on occasions rum wasn't available and it was substituted by cider. And Lind had made the observation that among the sailors who were given cider as opposed to rum, scurvy occurred, but not so frequently as among those given rum. And he wondered whether there was something in the apple, and therefore he developed what in fact, in medical history terms, can be described as the first clinical trial. He had on his ship, he divided his sailors into three groups. Those who were given rum, those who were given cider, and those who were given a citrus mixture, such as he was able to obtain, orange, lemon, or lime. And he just observed what happened. These journeys went on for months and months and months. Scurvy, as we now know, is a vitamin C deficiency disease, and it takes several months to become manifest. Bleeding gums, teeth fall out, rashes, internal bleeding, and ultimately death. That process takes 7 to 9 months to reach fulfillment. But these journeys took 7 to 9 months. So here was a controlled trial at sea of the efficacy of these three so-called treatments. The rum, I suppose, one would regard as a placebo. And of course, as you would expect, those who were given cider developed scurvy, but none of those who had citrus did. What a remarkable byproduct of exploration, in addition to chicona and coca. The great explorer of the Pacific Ocean, Cook, was familiar with fruits, and he provisioned his ships as he went from South Pacific Island to South Pacific Island and to what we now would call New Zealand. And none of his sailors developed scurvy. But I'm not sure whether he knew of Lind's work or not, but it just happened that that was so. Unfortunately, he came to grief while meeting the natives who were hostile in Hawaii and died and never made it back to England. Now, we learned yesterday about the development of the great European universities, and I mentioned that the first after Salerno was Bologna, and an offshoot of Bologna was Padua. And Padua is absolutely central to the scientific revolution and the events that followed and the discoveries that were made. Why? Because Padua, apart from Alexandria, a millennium before, Padua was the first university to use human cadaver dissection. And this set the foundations for understanding anatomy in all its complexity. Now, many of you, I'm sure, have the opportunity or had the opportunity to go to Italy. And if you find yourself again in the region of Venice, take the 20-minute ride on the Autostrada to Padua. Go to the university and ask to see the anatomical theatre. And this is it. And what is striking about it, it is actually preserved all the way from 1320 or whenever it was constructed to this very day in its original form. So the students would be lined up in tiers, all standing tier upon tier upon tier, looking down at where the cadaver was being dissected. And because the papacy had forbidden human dissection with that short little window for the Black Death, you remember, not until was human dissection permitted till the 1530s, this was to be done in semi-secrecy. And as a consequence, the dissection table was placed over a running stream, so that when the Pope's emissaries were in town, the cadaver was discreetly lowered onto a boat in the stream, the cadaver slipped away, tethered, one hopes, to recover later, and the nominal lecture continued. But that lecture theatre is still there. What a remarkable, tangible thing going to this important era. What diseases did these people suffer from? Well, we've talked about syphilis, but of course there was no diagnosis, there were very few descriptions of diseases that were consistent, and the most prevalent disease in England in the 15th century was called the sweating disease. Sweating, of course, a manifestation of fever, fever being probably the least specific symptom of just about every disease you can think of. But this is the disease that was paramount in England at the time, the sweating disease, indicating how ignorant people were as to causation or even classification, which is absolutely essential to understanding. There was another disease which was little more fanciful, but almost as prevalent, and that was Virgin's disease. And the characteristic of Virgin's disease that it would afflict only unmarried ladies of a certain age and who were afflicted with pallor and lethargy, for which the treatment was marriage and children. Syphilis, as we've seen and heard at the Baxter, was very much with us until really not too long ago with the advent of penicillin, all those many, many, many years. This is a famous picture by Rembrandt of the tertiary stage of the syphilis, where you can see the saddle nose deformity, which is quite characteristic of it. But around 1500, it was recognized that syphilis was a sexually transmitted disease. And in fact, a survey of the time demonstrated that in Venice, which was really the center of navigation in the eastern Mediterranean, 1 in 20 of the population was a prostitute. And so this was a revelation in terms of medical history to make this association to a sexually transmitted disease, which was so prevalent and had been for decades before. Smallpox was also endemic. And this is a picture in the banqueting hall in London of the ceiling showing the joint monarchy of William of Orange and Mary II of England, the joint they both ruled together at a certain period in English history as William and Mary. And Mary herself died of smallpox. It was no respecter, clearly, of rank. Then, of course, there was the second visitation of the Great Plague. We talked yesterday about the Black Death. It was the same illness as it afflicted London, Europe, Asia, coming from China, you remember, 1351, where a quarter of Europe's population died. It then became quiescent, and then re-emerged in England, particularly in 1665. Samuel Pepys, the great diarist, was alive at the time, stayed in London throughout, and made a number of observations of what was happening, the dead being brought out at night into dead carts, the fact that houses were boarded up, and there was an endless procession of ox carts taking people out of London, out of the way of the plague. Pepys's main concern, however, was the economic impact of the plague, and he felt particularly for the periwig makers whose business was ruined. Why? Because periwigs, which were fashionable, in fact, an absolutely mandatory item of wear for men at the time, fashionable men at the time, were made from hairs taken from cadavers before burial. And so because of the plague, the bottom fell out of the periwig industry, basically. The best description of the plague, though, was not Pepys's diary, but this, a journal of the plague year, being observations or memorials of the most remarkable occurrences, as well public as private, which happened in London during the last great visitation in 1665. And this was not Samuel Pepys, but was actually Defoe, the first English novelist. This was written 70 years, it's a novel, but I took it upon myself to read it. It was gathering dust in my library at home, never opened, and it's absolutely compelling reading. I have the details of how it affected relationships, how the economy collapsed completely, and how it was just, it's well worth a good read. This was published in 1722, and it's still in print, of course, in Penguin paperback. Look at this. This is not fiction. This is not a novel. This is a page taken from a ward of London where deaths were recorded. Standard practice following the Black Death. Remember, they had health officers, and the job of the health officer in the 1300s was to record deaths, the first time that that had actually been done. And here, 200 years later, we're actually seeing what happened in London in 1 week, in one ward of London. Just look at what these people died from. It makes interesting reading. The first one of interest is this one individual who was burnt in his bed by a candle at St. Giles, Cripplegate. 42, however, succumbed from childbed, which is presumably purposeful sepsis. Consumption took away 134, insofar as they could make an accurate diagnosis, of course. Fever, as we said, was very common, not knowing what it was, 309. A gripping of the guts, 51. One wonders if that's carcinoma of the colon or whatever it was. One doesn't know. A gripping of the guts, and there it is. Lethargy killed two people. That sounds good. And absolutely staggering, 11 died of rising of the lights. Now I would like to know what that is. 17 were stillborn. 121 died of teeth. But the figure that I want to draw your attention to is during this same week, 7,165 died of the plague. So many were dying that it was no longer possible to discreetly remove the dead into the dead house at night, but there was just a continuous procession of the dead being taken away for burial with no ceremony. Mercifully, difficult to say mercifully about a great fire that destroyed the greater part of the city, but the great fire of London 1 year later destroyed the rats among the buildings, and the rats, of course, harboured the fleas, which harboured the bacteria that caused bubonic. Who were the physicians? Well, there were four sorts of people who treated patients. I suppose we call them doctors. There were the very few elite graduates of the burgeoning medical schools. And these carried great status and commanded great fees and were available only to the wealthy and were in any event very few in number. Far more numerous were the barbers and the surgeons who served an apprenticeship, and they were let loose without any formality, without any recognition, any diploma or anything, to do what they did, and essentially what they did was simply lance foils, splinted broken limbs, and occasionally did an amputation. The family friend was in fact the apothecary. And the apothecary is rather akin today to our friendly corner pharmacist or chemist. And how many of you, rather than go to your doctor, pop over to your pharmacist, say, I've got this, I've got that, and he says, oh, let me have a look, yes, why don't you try this, try that? And we do that today, and this is, I suspect, what the large majority of people did at this time. The apothecary sold herbs, some minerals, ground up powders, most of very doubtful value, of course, gave advice, that also sold groceries on the side. And then, of course, there were the charlatans, and these abounded. There were the tooth pullers, the midwives seeking custom, and various others. And then there were quite sophisticated charlatans, such as the bumpologist. And the bumpologist would say, come here, my good boy, and let me see what's the matter with you. And he'd lay his hand on his forehead, and he'd feel the bumps and say, aha, take this. He'd give him this and charge a fee, and of course it was a complete mumbo-jumbo. What do we know about the cause of disease? Because you can't be logical about treatment, of course, unless you have some notion of the cause of disease. And of course, the humours were alive and well. We saw yesterday that we were using a little miniature of somebody being given an emetic and then serenaded while he slept. Purgatives were given to redress the imbalance of the fluids in the body by causing diarrhea, so that set the balance right. And of course, sweating was another way to get rid of fluid. And it was a fashion to sweat out your fever. And I remember my mother telling me when I had a fever, you must sweat it out, my boy. And the cartoonists, of course, had a field day with that. There was another theory, though, put forward by an Italian physician, Fran Castrio, who thought that this disease was caused by seeds. I don't know the Italian for seeds, and I was unable to get the reference. But seeds is what he described. And he said that these seeds were transmissible from one person to another. My gosh, he was right on the money, wasn't he? 300 years before germs were identified by this Pasteur. He was, of course, laughed out of town, and the prevailing view of the cause of disease was miasma. Now, miasma is some mysterious vapor that emanates from marshes, bogs, rubbish, garbage rotting, excreta, and notably from the poor. And of course, this was mumbo jumbo as well. And from this concept of miasma, I remember my mother telling me not only to sweat out my fever, but she would open the windows wide, presumably to let out the miasma, I don't know. But it carries through generation after generation. What about medications? What was actually available? Well, you remember the Egyptians had developed a large pharmacy from Thutmose III's herb garden, you remember, through to Dioscorides in Greece, who had formulated 500 herbs, 44 of which were used into the 20th century, 11 of which were thought to have any value, the rest were valueless. And the follower of Dioscorides was this man called Paracelsus. Now, Paracelsus, that wasn't his real name. He called himself Paracelsus because he considered himself modestly the equal of Celsus, who was a renowned Roman physician, but secretly he thought himself his superior. His real name, I've written it down here, let me see if I can find it for you. His real name was Alphonsus, I didn't record it down. But his middle name was Bombastus. Von Hohenheim was his real surname. Von Hohenheim, Aurelius, Bombastus, von Hohenheim. And he was a bombastic individual. He was also a bit loopy because he believed in elves. But he was a legitimate physician, trained in Basel, and was going around, and he compiled a pharmacopoeia, which we need to take seriously. And it is to Paracelsus that we owe the introduction of mercury into medications. Now, mercury, we now know, is a poison. Yet, mercury was widely held as the great cure. And even up until the beginning of the 20th century, the Victorian family doctor would carry in his bag powders containing mercury. Not pure mercury, of course, but there will be various things, chalk and various other things, but mercury was thought to be the issue. I suppose you can say that he was actually responsible for some help with regard to syphilis, because mercury did seem to have some effect in syphilis, although it was never set up in a controlled situation. We don't know if it was effective or not. And it's from Paracelsus that the expression arose, which I'm sure you're familiar with, an hour with Venus, a lifetime with mercury. There was an Englishman, Nicholas Culpepper, who followed Paracelsus, and who was equally flamboyant. And he made his fortune selling his medications and his pharmacopoeia, which he wrote out meticulously. And this is the frontispiece from his original pharmacopoeia. He calls it the English Physician, or an astrological-physical discourse on the vulgar herbs of this nation. So this was the first pharmacopoeia to appear in English. And he goes on, being a complete method of physic, whereby a man may preserve his body in health, or cure himself, being sick, for 3 pence charge, with such things only as grow in England, they being most fit for English bodies. And he goes on. But he did actually recognize the value of the foxglove. And the foxglove, we now know, gives rise to digitalis, which is still the mainstay of treatment for cardiac insufficiency. So, mercury maybe, but digitalis, yes. So we shouldn't laugh completely at these people. But furthermore, Culpepper's pharmacopoeia became the basis for the first pharmacopoeia to be produced by the Royal College of Physicians in London, which went on producing editions right through to the beginning of this last century. Treatments then were pharmaceutical, such as they were, almost all botanical, some minerals, but still bleeding was another way, newly introduced, of readdressing the imbalance of the humours. We had vomiting, we had diarrhea, we had sweating, and now bleeding was very commonly employed. And here you can see some treatment centre, I'm not sure what to call it, a doctor's office or a consulting room or a hospital or what, but hanging from the ceiling are bowls which you would reach up and use, in which the blood would be drawn. And so bleeding was the number one method of treating anybody who came to try to redress the balance of the humours. Another way of doing this was to insert setons. I had no idea what a seton was, but it turns out it's a thread mounted on a needle which is then passed under the skin, and the thread is left there, the needle is withdrawn, and the idea is that the evil, whatever it is causing the malady, can escape from the hole where the needle passed through the skin along the track of the seton. So this mindset of the humours is so ingrained, but receiving these rather curious, inventive approaches. Cupping was another way to bring the badness out of the skin. You would take a glass sphere with a narrow neck, heat it so the air inside was very hot, and then immediately place the open end over the skin. And as the air cooled down, it would contract in volume and draw the skin up, so you would end up with great welts, drawing out the evil that was causing the disease. Isn't this absolutely extraordinary, all these extents, with the absence of any other knowledge? The bottom line is that there were some pretty shrewd people about in England at the time who regarded all this as charlatanry. Joseph Addison was the first editor of the Spectator magazine. I don't know any of you who spent any time in England to know that magazine. It was founded in the early 18th century. When I was a schoolboy, it was one of the mandatory subscriptions that we could take out. If you were right bent, you took out the Spectator. If you were leftward bent, you took out the New Statesman. And if you were neutral, you subscribed to the London Times. But Joseph Addison was in fact the first editor. He was a pretty shrewd man, and in those days you didn't mince your words when you were criticising politicians, which they did vigorously, and I'm glad to see that that tendency remains alive and well in the headline of the Cape Times this morning. And he said, he knew they were charlatans, and he said, "When a nation abounds in physicians, it grows thin of people." And he had it absolutely. And as a consequence of that charlatanry, which all of this was, of course, well-intentioned charlatanry, but charlatanry nonetheless, this gave rise to the homeopathic movement. Christian Hahnemann, German, 1750 or thereabouts, had the notion that if you gave a small dose of something that was reproducing the symptom of the disease, you would thereby cure the disease. What made him think of that, I don't know. But isn't that exactly what we do with immunization? I don't know that he had any notion of that at all. It just occurs to me. And this homeopathy thrived because it was realized as charlatanry of conventional medicine and treatment of the time. What about surgeons? Well, we saw the itinerant barber and surgeon. Henry VIII gave a charter to barbers and to surgeons, but the charter was not in the form of a royal college, such as he'd given in 1511 to the Royal College of Physicians, but he really granted them status as a guild. And they were on the same level, the surgeons. They had their charter from Henry VIII, but had the same status in society as a chandler or a fishmonger or whatever. And that was the status of the surgeon. Surgeons were generally regarded as butchers, sailists, and bear in mind that operations needed to be done for gangrene or injuries. If you were run over with a cart, your foot would be gangrenous. If there was a compound fracture, no antibiotics, of course, and amputation was the only way to save your life. And no anesthesia, no hemostasis, no antibiotic, no blood. And so this was the state. Aren't we glad that we're alive now? Have no illusions about what was life like in the romantic days that we read about. out of these, the great courtiers and musicians, this is the reality. There was one honourable exception, Ambroise Paré, physician to Henry II in France and two succeeding kings, who learnt his skills. What a thoughtful statue and what a thoughtful man, head and shoulders above surgery that had taken place in Europe at that time. Ambroise Paré learnt his skills as the chief physician to the French army for 30 years, and there he was dealing with injuries of all sorts. And it is to Ambroise Paré that the concept of ligating a blood vessel that you divide, we owe that to him. I mean, what could be more fundamental than when you cut something in a vessel that's bleeding, spurting blood, you tie it off? Well, as surgeons, we do that in our sleep, that's what we do for our bread and butter. But this was revolutionary. Prior to that, if you had an amputation and you survived the psychic and physical shock of what was being done to you, to stop the bleeding, they put a red hot iron there, which coagulated everything, and then covered that with hot tar. And Ambroise Paré, with all his experience in the military, realized that you needed to ligate things. And he also carried out some operations. The thoracic cavity, the abdominal cavity, of course, were completely out of the question, without antibiotics, blood transfusion, and anesthesia. So all the surgery that Paré did was peripheral on the limbs, but did attempt mastectomy. Survival, and even thyroid, take a nodule out of the thyroid gland on the neck, ligating the vessels that were bleeding. What a major advance compared to the butchers who were hacking away elsewhere. He developed quite sophisticated prostheses for his wounded soldiers as well. And there's another figure worth noting, and that is William Smillie. Gynecologist in Edinburgh University, who was appalled at babies being stuck in course of second stage of delivery, dying in their mother's dying as a consequence, and developed the obstetric forceps. So a major advance in that one respect. So all was not negative. Hospitals were being built. Of course, I was privileged in my younger days to do my clinical training at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London. And St. Bartholomew's Hospital was founded in the year 1123 by Ray Heer, who was a crusader. And Ray Heer went to the Holy Land and declared that he fell victim to a fever, presumably typhus or typhoid, we don't know which. And he declared to God in a prayer that if he were to be saved, he would found a hospital for the sick poor of London. And by Jingo, he was saved, and he did stick to his word, founded St. Bartholomew's in 1123, and he's buried in the chapel there in the traditional pose over his sarcophagus. But that was rare. St. Thomas's Hospital followed, hospitals in Paris, but it was in Vienna, particularly in Europe, ahead of Paris, where there were hospitals in Paris, but it was particularly Vienna General Hospital that became the centre of focus for some 300 years, up until the beginning of the 20th century. So this all sets the scene for what really is the meat of the scientific revolution, what actually happened scientifically speaking. And I think our story in this context begins with the painter of the Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci, who was of course much, much more than a painter. He was an architect, he was a civil engineer, he was a botanist, he was an observer of nature. But what was not widely known was that he produced 700 detailed anatomical drawings that lay completely hidden and unknown after his death, to be discovered only at the beginning of the 19th century. And these anatomical drawings were absolutely remarkable. We know that his interest, let me just go back for a second, we know that his interest in anatomical drawing was so that he could better form his figures in his painting. After all, what you see on the outside is a representation of what is inside. But he was far more interested beyond that. He just had an inquiring mind, of course, to put it mildly. And his anatomical dissections were not only confined to animals, ox dissections, in which he recognized the valves of the left side of the heart and the right side of the heart, demonstrated they were one-way valves. Blood coming in, we had known that blood was coming in through the blue system, the veins, entered the right side of the heart. He knew that it left the heart on the arterial side, He recognised that the valve on the right side of the heart was a one-way valve admitting blood into the heart, and he recognised that the valve on the left side of the heart was one-way letting blood out of the heart. He couldn't quite make the leap that therefore there was a circulation. And that was what Harvey to discover shortly as we'll see. But this just gives you an example of the fanaticism with which he went about his work. That's not meant to be a pejorative word. It's absolutely remarkable. The pregnant uterus he discovered in his dissection and drew his concept. And what could be more accurate than that? A modern obstetric manual doesn't really advance us any further. Writing, of course, in his mirror writing, as he always did with annotations. But real anatomical advance really came with this man, Vesalius, Antonio Vesalius, who was professor of anatomy in Padua, where you recall the anatomical theatre still exists, and where anatomical human dissection was carried out for the first time. And there he was professor of anatomy and medicine, and there he did his dissections, which were way beyond anything that had ever been done there before. He had a collaborator, Caleb, who was a lithographer, and his great work was De Humani Corporis Fabrica, How the Body is Made. What an advance. And he had his illustrator illustrate what he had dissected out of the course of 30 years as professor of anatomy in Padua. And his models were really, isn't that quaint? He had taken the skin off the pig cadaver and had posed it in this way. And the artist copied that, and this was a lithograph, and this formed the illustration of his book. Absolutely remarkable, accurate anatomical description of the superficial muscles of the body here, but many, many, many more illustrations going deep inside. He even recognized the 12 cranial nerves. And you ask any medical student today to recite the 12 cranial nerves and where they're located, they will be found. And here he was describing with great accuracy the cranial nerves as they emerged from the base of the brain. And his work stimulated other anatomists, even more detailed dissection. And here we see a magnificent dissection of the side of the face and the neck. And here is revealed something that was completely unknown previously, the parotid gland. Can you see that situated just here? And recognizing structures that didn't seem to have any function that they knew about stimulated the whole concept of physiology. How does it all work? The anatomists tell you what's there. But here is the physiology. How does it all work? It stimulated a whole new line of experimentation, culminating, of course, with William Harvey, physician at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, who also trained in anatomy in Padua, who had read in his researches that veins had valves. And he thought to himself, the prevailing wisdom at the time was that of Galen, that blood is formed in the liver, you remember, travels in the veins to the heart, travels through the invisible non-existent septum in the pores and septum of the ventricles, and then through the arterial system where the blood is absorbed in the tissues. If so, why do veins have valves? And Harvey came across a very, just thought of a very simple way of demonstrating what he postulated, that was that the blood actually circulated. There was a continuous movement from the veins through the heart to the arteries and back to the veins again. And this very, very simple experiment, this is what I was saying earlier, you think that these bolts of genius strike you like a lightning bolt. Not at all. It was building on what had happened before, and he just made one logical deduction from what had been observed. And so he did a simple experiment. He applied a tourniquet around the upper arm, not so tight as to obstruct arterial blood flow, but tight enough to prevent the veins, which are much thinner walled and more superficial, from carrying the blood back to the heart. And so he put his tourniquet on, and lo and behold, the veins all swelled up. And then he amused himself by putting his finger on different points of the vein and watching the blood shoot to the next point of obstruction, demonstrating there was clearly the passage of blood from peripheral in a central direction. He postulated, the puzzle for him was, how does the blood get from the arterial side to the veins? And the blood seemed to disappear in the tissues and reappear, and he postulated there must be very small vessels, too small to be seen, which of course is the truth, and we would all call those capillaries. what it is. Not a bolt of lightning, but just an intuitive step of building on built on what had gone before. And his great work, of course, was De motu cordis et sanguinis, of the motions of the heart and the blood. And he had this published eventually. It was in 1722, I think, when it was finally published. But he was aware that there was a Spanish physician called Servetus who had been executed. Servetus had proposed that there was a pulmonary circulation, completely unknown to Galen. Not sure if circulation is the word, but he demonstrated that blood went into the lungs and came out from the lungs, and it was a different colour on either side. Yet he was executed. And so Harvey was very afeard that the same fate would befall him for the heresy of contradicting Galen. It turned out that Servetus was executed because he was an ardent Protestant, a follower of Luther, and he refused to recant the heresy, and for that he was executed. But I'm not sure if Harvey knew that. So Harvey took a precaution. He was a smart man. He dedicated his book to King Charles I. And in his dedication he wrote, "The heart, like the king, is the sun, the fountain from which all grace and power flow." Super fancy if ever there was. It saved his life, perhaps. How to find a capillary? We knew it was there, but we had to demonstrate it, and here we have to turn to the Dutch town of Delft. We've never been to Delft, but it's famous, the most beautiful place. The town of Vermeer, of course, and where also lived a linen merchant, Antonin van Leeuwenhoek. And Leeuwenhoek was a linen merchant whose sight was failing him. And as a linen merchant, you had to judge the quality of the bales of linen in order to fix a price. And as his eyes were failing, he was also, by chance, an amateur lens maker for his glasses, and some of his lenses were thicker than others and had a magnifying quality. And he used these to magnify to see the weave of the linen to determine its quality. And it wasn't long before he played with his lenses. He was also an amateur botanist, and used his lens for close examination of the veins and leaves and various other botanical structures. And it didn't take very long for the idea to catch on with John Hook, the famous English natural scientist, to put Leeuwenhoek's lenses together and make the first practical microscope. And as a result of the microscope, see how things build one upon the other. This is an extraordinary, it's not lightning. I always used to think it was lightning. These men are just born geniuses. Putting things together in the same way that Gutenberg had imitated his father. And of course it was with the microscope that the capillaries were first identified by Fabricio, and the whole circuit of the blood was finally established. This was a time of great intellectual ferment, of course, and around this time, the first edition, there were many learned societies many major cities like Berlin, Vienna, Paris and London formed learned societies to try to absorb all this information, but more importantly, to give physicians status, because scientists were the ones who commanded the state. Physicians were okay, given the therapeutic uselessness of what they did. They were regarded as intellectuals, but inferior intellectuals. So societies were formed to bring physicians into the intellectual ferment and hopefully give them additional status. So this is the front page of the first Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London. And read what it says there. Philosophical Transactions, giving some account of the present undertakings, studies, and labours of the ingenious in many considerable parts of the world. And there we are, published in 1665 by chance, the year of the Great Plague. What's prompted the formation of these learned societies was the ferment generated by this man, René Descartes, a great French philosopher who wrote many, many, many works in philosophy, but he also had his own ideas as to how the body worked. And he regarded the body as being in two parts, the mind and the material. The material part of the body was the bits you could feel, and the mind was the mind. But furthermore, he argued that contrary to Galen, that the body was in fact a machine. And if instead of dis-ease, as Galen had proposed, as a cause of illness, an imbalance of the humours, he regarded illness as a machine malfunctioning. And the machine, of course, had come from the anatomical dissections and the physiological studies. Well, the body is a machine in that context. And Descartes had proposed this theory that the body was a machine. And as a result of that, people were examining all aspects of the machine. And this is an absolutely wonderful illustration of a machine built to study a machine. It's the machine of balance developed by Santorio, an Italian, what we would now call physiologist, I suppose, scientist, that's what he described himself as, natural scientist. And he was interested in food. How did food affect the machine? And so what he did was he had an individual, a subject, he measured out with great accuracy the amount of food the individual was about to eat. He measured the excreta from the individual, thinking that they would balance equally. And he made the observation that in fact there was a loss of weight beyond the excretion of the food that had been taken. It wasn't just in equals what comes out. And he had recognized there was such a thing as insensible loss. The insensible loss being the carbon dioxide you breathe out, perspiration that comes from the pores of the skin, and heat that's generated by the food. So the missing factor were those two things, and that's accounting for the additional loss of weight. The intellectual ferment that was going on at the time, I think you can feel it. You may say, well, big deal, okay. But given where they were coming from, this was a phenomenal intellectual leap. And so here we are, physiology advancing, better metabolism being studied, the circulation being studied, Galvani and Volta discovering electricity, wondering whether the electricity was the medium whereby the machine worked. All these things were fermenting in these people's brains. And then, of course, there was Antoine Laurent de Lavoisier, a nobleman who was also a dealer, a trader, and an aristocrat, and a chemist. While they discovered oxygen previously, the transactions of the learned societies were coming out, so information was exchangeable. Printing was readily available, of course, so the information could be widely disseminated. And Lavoisier recognized that oxygen turned into carbon dioxide in the body. So here we have respiratory physiology now. We have metabolism, we have the circulation, respiratory physiology, all beginning to come together to make sense, the beginnings of what we now accept as absolutely standard physiology. Paul Lavoisier, though, was born at the wrong time. He was right in the middle of the French Revolution. He was a politician, apart from being a merchant and a scientist, and he was caught up in the terror that followed the French Revolution, and in 1794, he was executed on a trumped-up charge that he had adulterated the tobacco he was selling. In fact, this was settling political scores, but thereby the world lost a great scientist. There were limitations to Descartes' theory, though, that the body was a machine. The first was, how does the body repair itself? If you injure itself, we know we usually get better. But he had no explanation for how the machine repairs itself, or the relationship between the mind and the body. That was totally foreign. And what about reproduction? Machines don't usually reproduce. So, what it comes down to is this tremendous intellectual ferment was going on. Real advances in understanding of science were taking place. But how did this translate into medicine? And the answer is, sadly, not. In fact, the physician, even the learned physician we see here, was left to gaze at the urine of his patient to try to discern what was the matter in the absence of any understanding of pathology, which was the missing link, of course. And such physicians were frequently derided as piss prophets. There were, however, two advances, just to end on a positive note. And this is a portrait of Lady Mary Walkley Montagu in 1721. Lady Montagu was the wife of the British ambassador to the Sultan of Turkey in Constantinople. And she had observed that smallpox was rife. She knew about it in England before she went out to Turkey. It was rife, endemic in Turkey itself. But she had observed Turkish mothers going to afflicted people. One of the manifestations of smallpox, I'm sure you know, is a blister like chickenpox. And there's a blister burst. You have some pyrrolic material in the base of the blister, containing what we now know as the smallpox virus. And she had recognized that Turkish mothers were taking a stick, touching the smallpox sore, and scratching the skin of their children with this, a process that was called variolation. And many of those children never got smallpox. Unknown to Lady Watley, some died as a result of that inoculation, but the large majority seemed to become immune. She was so impressed with this that she had her own children variolated. Word through the learned societies and the printing press reached Boston, and in Boston a program was instituted for mass variolation. But as they made their analysis of the results of that program, some indeed did succumb from smallpox, so everything ground to a halt for 70 years. And it was only with the advent of Edward Jenner, who had picked up another observation among the girls who milked cows afflicted with cowpox. And as they were milking the udders to get the milk, the afflicted cow would have the cowpox sore, some of which had ruptured, the virus it contained went onto the hands, and it was extremely rare for these girls ever to get smallpox. And he knew of the experiment in Boston, he knew of Lady Watley. And so he initiated a trial, as we would now call it, of taking the pus from cows affected with cowpox and inoculating. And that, of course, proved to be hugely successful, with no cases of smallpox being developed, yet the cross-immunity between smallpox and cowpox seemed almost 100%. Pure chance. But there we were. And as a result of that, we can say, when you say at the end of this overview survey of 300 years condensed into 50 minutes, what is the take-home message? That in spite of all the fundamental advances that were made in terms of basic science, this is the one thing that led finally to the eradication of smallpox from the face of the earth. All starting with Lady Walker's observation, etc. There's one other, and cowpox, of course, was a great source of mirth to the inoculation program, a great source of mirth to the cartoonists. And here we are, everyone who'd been inoculated is developing cows coming out of every which part. I've not said a word in 3 days on psychiatry, other than to mention Sophocles and Euripides as possibly the precursors of psychiatry insofar as human emotion was recognized as influencing human behavior and outcome. How were the insane, as we would rudely call them, I suppose, in times gone by, regarded? Well, it went in phases. For many periods, those touched by insanity were thought perhaps touched by God. And therefore, if you touched the cloak, the clothes of an insane person, somehow that blessing would be transmitted to you. More often, they were regarded as a figure of fun, as you can see here. And then, of course, witchcraft was one of the causes of epidemics, disease, plague, what have you. And consequently, if you were a witch causing terrible things, you were burnt at the stake. So as many mad people were burnt as were touched for that blessing. Because of the scientific approach, largely due to Descartes, thinking that the body is a machine, surely he reasoned, and so did physicians reason, that perhaps mental illness was also a machine that was a little bit awry. And so the whole scientific approach towards disease, anatomy, physiology, was then brought to bear on psychiatric illness. And psychiatric hospitals were built in order to gather together people so they could be studied. Well, they tried all the usual pharmaceuticals, the botanicals, the minerals, and everything else, and of course nothing worked. And then they tried physical things. A machine is a physical thing, after all, and if it's abnormal, if you shake it, what's the thing you do when your computer doesn't work? You press all the buttons, and before you do the final thing, which is read the manual, you give it a kick, And this is what they did with these people. So they were treated with physical assaults in the same belief that kicking a computer would cause the malfunctioning bit to suddenly fall into place. And so they were treated with douches of cold water. They were left in darkened rooms for days or even weeks at a time, hoping that sensory deprivation would cause a rearrangement of the malfunctioning neurons. Even a spinning chair, similar to those used to train supersonic aircraft pilots or NASA astronauts to build your body up to G resistance. And they were spun, and when they stopped spinning, they were exactly the same as they were before. So this was all a little bit disappointing. I had dinner the other evening, I don't know if it's in the audience, with a former professor of psychiatry at this distinguished university. And I said, tell me, did you think there were any advances in psychiatry before Freud? And he said, oh, yes. But I still can't quite remember what they were. But you see, I apologize for this quotation. But there was hope. And this hope took the form of a Quaker, William Tuke, an English Quaker, who worked with a company of Quakers in England, among whom was some who had some mental affliction. And he knew what was happening to mental patients in mental hospitals, so-called, and how ineffective it all was. And he thought that perhaps kindness would do more good than the physical abuses to which they were subjected. And he founded what was actually called the York Retreat, where you can see it's furnished a bit like the lobby of a hotel. Perhaps the Manhattan looked like this in its earlier days. And patients would be brought in and treated with kindness. They would not be shackled. They were treated with kindness. They would be well fed. They would be given things to do. And I'm going to leave you on that note, because tomorrow I'm going to tell you how well that worked or didn't work. And there we'll stop. Thank you for your attention.